So hello everybody. It's a great pleasure. This is a little what makes you click special. I'm very pleased to be joined this afternoon actually by my former PhD student, Dr. Karen Griffin. I just thought it'd be nice for us to A, catch up, because I haven't seen Karen much since she finished her PhD and published this paper, which is going to be the focus of what we want to talk about. Karen published a really nice study as part of her PhD, Can This Dog Be Rehomed to You? A Qualitative Analysis and Assessment of the Scientific Quality of the Potential Adopter Screening Policies and Procedures of Rehoming Organizations. And yes, the reason why my eyes move to the side is because I have to read that off the screen. I've not lived and breathed it quite as much as Karen has, but we've published the paper open access because we really felt it was very important that it gets out there, and just thought it'd be nice for us to have a little catch up about it, chat about it, and what's important. And you know, people who don't like reading papers, they might want to just watch a short YouTube clip. So that's where we're going to put it there, and we'll put it onto the various other sites as well. So welcome, Karen. Lovely to see you.
Thank you.
How
Thank
are you?
I'm well, thank you. I'm well, thank you for having me.
It's lovely to see you. So let's start, before we get into all the other things I'd like to catch up with you about, let's just start by talking a little bit about this paper and the main findings about it. And, you know, then we'll talk a little bit about how it came about, because I think it's also quite useful to share that with other people as well. Mm-hmm. So this was a really big undertaking, and although you're based in California, you came over to the UK to do this bit of work, and I'm really grateful for you for doing that, simply because, but I think it has global significance results. So I'll hand over to you, let you describe the results in your own words.
Yep. So yes, I agree. It definitely has global implications, at very least. Maybe not for the entire world, but at least for Western Europe, the US, Canada, et cetera. So from the paper, we learned a few things, and I don't think it's a stretch to say that the things that we learned, the primary results, I think that a lot of people already supposed this, and it really confirmed what they already thought. But at any rate, so we learned that rehoming organizations, shelters, et cetera, when they are screening for potential adopters, so people that have inquired about adopting a dog, either a specific dog or just they want to adopt a dog in general, organizations want to find out a great amount of information about the potential home that this dog or any dog is going to go to. It falls under a number of what we call themes and sub-themes, so hence why it's a qualitative analysis. We end up with over 30 different factors about adopters or potential adopters and their home environment, their lifestyle, et cetera, that organizations want to find out about. So for example, they want to find out all about their accommodations. So do they live in a flat? Do they have a garden? Do they have a fence? How high is the fence? Is the fence secure? You know, they want to find out who lives in the home. Are there children? Are there young children? How many hours will the dog be left alone? If the dog is going to be left alone, do they have special kind of plans in place so that someone can check in on the dog? So it's a very wide range of things, which again, I don't think is surprising to anybody who's ever gone to adopt a dog. But it turns out that of these factors, and these are factors, like I said, that organizations say are very important to us. These are things we really want to know about. That within that, there is a subset of factors that organizations, and not all organizations, but some, say if an adopter does not meet this criteria, they cannot have a dog from us. So if they do not have a 5-foot fence, I'm sorry, you can't have a dog. Never mind if it's a Chihuahua who's 15 years old and, you know, can barely stand on its hind legs, you cannot have a dog from us. So this is not to say that's true of all organizations. Some are very flexible and they're very willing to accommodate, but some are not. So there's that. So we found that they're asking a lot of things and a big chunk of those things are what we call pass-fail criteria. So if you don't meet X criteria, you can't have a dog. I'm sorry, goodbye. And again, I think that this resonates with a lot of people who have gone to adopt a dog, and because they don't have a garden with a secure 5-foot fence or whatever it is, they can't get a dog from that organization and may turn to less favorable means of acquiring a dog. So that's what we kind of found. And then we said, okay, well, we know that they're gathering all of this information. Why are they gathering it? So we kind of came up with three possible reasons that they are. On the one hand, there is relinquishment risk. So are these various factors or characteristics associated in the scientific published literature with a statistically increased risk for relinquishment? So for example, if there are young children in the home, is that dog more likely to be returned to the organization? So that was one. The second one was, is there a safety risk associated with these factors? So, and generally we're looking at, in this case, a risk to human safety. So is there a relationship, for example, between having, again, young children in the home and an increased risk for something to go wrong in terms of safety? The third factor we looked at was, hey, maybe these organizations are really wanting to know this information because they're concerned about the quality of life of the dog. So do they think that a dog who lives in a flat will have a worse quality of life than one will who lives in a large detached home? So we kind of took these three things and we said, okay, now let's look at the literature. Let's see what information has already been generated and what we can kind of prove, what evidence is there. So we went to the literature and we found a few things, though not a lot of information. So in terms of relinquishment risk, we found that there are some of these factors that are associated with an increased risk for relinquishment. It is a very short list of
such as just for the benefit
eight,
of people.
Yeah, it's about eight characteristics. So children, young children in the home, so children under 4 years old, under 5 years old, or what's just referred to as young children, which is a bit of a catch-all, but we can kind of assume it's something along those lines under, you know.
But these are, I'm going to jump in here, these are manageable risks as well. So it's not.
Yes.
So we know that they're associated with increased risk. Mm-hmm. But some of these are manageable. So we could put resources, if we had them, towards trying to succeed in that situation. Yep, is that absolutely fair to say?
Yep, absolutely. And so I'm going to loop back to that. Yeah, so we know, so yes, you're absolutely right. So there are these factors that are associated with an increased risk for relinquishment. If we then look at safety risk, and in that we were looking at literature that has looked at injury to humans that has caused a visit to a hospital or doctor, so typically bite wounds. And we found that, again, children, young children, are associated with a risk to human safety. So children in the home may lead there to be, if a dog goes into that home, the children may be harmed. Mm-hmm. So then the third thing we looked at was welfare, quality of life of the dog. There's pretty much no literature on this.
So that in itself, I think, is a really important finding, is that what this paper does is it not only points out about some of the criteria that people are using just seem to be quite arbitrary, but also that it says that there's this whole issue of welfare that hasn't been looked at, and we really perhaps need to be looking at it. And, you know, so there's an awful lot in here, and people can read the paper, and we will provide the link to the paper so that people can read it in full. There are really important gaps in our knowledge.
No, absolutely. And that's one of the things that we said was, hey, we're not saying that, for example, one of the factors that organizations look for is cannot have laminate flooring in main areas of the house. This is something that's very specific. So unless you have a paper that goes and says, hey, all these dogs that were relinquished, did you guys have laminate flooring in your house? Then we're not going to know. Yeah. So yes, there are big gaps, and we don't know. So for the time being, in terms of the types of information that organizations are gathering, it looks like there are four, or there's one kind of subset that's really key. And we're not saying don't adopt a dog to these families, to these homes, but hey, they might just need a little bit more support. So it looks
like... Put a mat like... down if you've got laminate flooring, for example.
Exactly.
The dog can walk.
Exactly, exactly. But of the two, of these two purposes that we're looking at, safety risk and relinquishment risk, children in the home, young children in the home is kind of the big one. So young children in the home are both cause a dog to be more likely to be relinquished and are more likely to lead to safety risk. So it's not surprising they probably go hand in hand, because if a dog hurts a child, the dog is probably or may well be relinquished. So again, we're not saying, hey, don't adopt to families that have children, but rather what can we do to set them up for success for everybody?
Yeah, but also I think there is the fact, and you looked at, you contacted, well, you contacted loads of organizations, but about 80 of them responded. Yep. And should say, we're really grateful to everybody who took the time to send you all that information.
Indeed.
But, you know, one of the things, any charity is under pressure of limited resources.
Absolutely.
And it seems that a lot of they're deploying a lot of resources on something which probably is not a good use of those resources. And it'd be better on the other end, actually
exactly.
helping
exactly.
The people with the dogs and helping the dogs fit in than just sort of saying, we're spending all this time screening people. Actually,
exactly. And we know that the stakes are high. Like, we know that they have limited resources. We know that they have, you know, a board of trustees, whomever to answer to say, hey, look at all that we've done. But actually, if we look at the literature, you know, all these organizations are spending so much time on the pre-adoption, kind of the front half. So, you know, interviews, questionnaires, et cetera. Actually, the literature suggests that it's post-adoption support that in terms of relinquishment risk is key.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah.
And it's exactly like, I mean, there are also the interesting factors, and I know several organizations said, you know, we won't rehome a dog to somebody who lives in a flat, because mm-hmm. they're worried that the dogs won't have access to sort of free exercise. Well, mm-hmm. There is data to suggest that a lot of people who live in flats who have a dog make extra effort to walk their dog because mm-hmm. they are concerned. And
yep.
people with gardens actually their dogs might not be getting as much exercise.
Exactly. No, we're making the assumption that a garden equals exercise, which therefore equals improved quality of life.
Yeah.
But that's an erroneous assumption to necessarily make.
And this is the problem. People have a belief and they just reinforce that belief without the evidence or without necessarily thinking about the practical solutions which could help the dog welfare as well.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So yeah, so we're saying, hey, just kind of relax everything on the front end, you know, and instead prepare these people for this huge change in their life. We know that a mismatch of expectations is something else that can be kind of a flag, can lead to relinquishment risk. So how much, what an owner expects in terms of the amount of work, the amount of anything involved in dog ownership versus what they actually get. So we know that that can also lead to breakdown the relationship and the dog being rehomed. So if we instead say, hey, let's focus on preparing these people for this huge change, because whatever dog they get, even if they're seasoned dog owners, it's a change. Mm-hmm. It's a change in family structure. It's a change in kind of their lifestyle. So let's try to prepare them for this. And again, with children in the home, as we said in the paper, you know, one of the things that we can do to help and to prepare them is to make sure that parents and that families know how to mitigate risk with young children and dogs.
And actually, it's really important that young kids have exposure to dogs so they learn how to manage risk appropriately. Now, you know,
exactly.
We're not saying just chuck the kids and the dogs together and they'll soon learn the hard way. But, you know, but if we have this situation whereby people aren't willing to rehome dogs with children, then those children aren't getting the opportunity to learn in a supportive environment.
Exactly.
And yeah, and equally, they're not getting the benefits of having a dog in the home as well. And, you know, there's so much growing work to suggest how valuable pets can be. I read a thing a number of years ago that in the US, a child is more likely to grow up with a pet in the family than with a father figure. Was it their father figure, or was it their father? I think a pet and their father, and the father figure, maybe it was a dog and a father figure or something. It's really sad because you know, for a lot of kids, you know, the dog is a valuable person for them to go and chat to.
For sure. Yeah. So absolutely, we're not, and like I said, we are acknowledging that, you know, hey, these are situations that might be a bit more precarious, so this is what we can do, this is how we can support them. And then once they're in the home, you know, again, that follow-up support. The literature has shown that 1 year post-adoption, a dog remains at an increased risk for relinquishment, and it's particularly so for the first 3 months post-adoption. So let's suggest organizations focus their resources there.
Really trying to help people. So what's going to be in the next paper from your PhD?
So we looked at what organizations were screening for with their adopters. Now we kind of have to look at the other side of the coin. So there's been a fair bit of research that has looked at the usefulness, the validity, and the reliability of different types of tools or tests or assessments to screen dogs pre-adoption. So that's gotten a lot of research attention. What necessarily hasn't gotten as much attention is, regardless of how they're doing it, what kind of information about a dog are organizations looking to get? So what do they want to know about this dog before they go and adopt the dog out, regardless of how they, think they're getting the information? Again, validity and reliability are a separate thing. But so it's kind of the other side of the coin. So you want to know this about an adopter. Now let's find out what they want to know about dogs. And are there things about dogs on the other side, this kind of pass-fail scoring, are there things about dogs that will lead them to determine that this dog can't be rehomed at all? So that's kind of the next step.
We need to be cracking on with that one. I know I'm probably the dam stopping it flow at the moment, but I will try and get it sorted. COVID has changed things a little bit, but and the other thing I just wanted to just say, because you self-funded your PhD, and you know, the simple question is why? Why would anyone want to pay to put themselves through the PhD? No, in all seriousness, it did mean that you could pursue this, which I know is something that you're very passionate about. And
yes,
you know, the reason, it's fair to say, the reason why you funded yourself was you're passionate about it, and the opportunities for funding in this area are very, very limited.
You hit the nail on the head. Exactly. I mean, it was many years ago that I started my PhD. It was a long journey, but such is it. It got done. Exactly. There were days we weren't sure. But no, you're exactly right. I may be terrible at statistics, maybe slightly better at the end than at the beginning, but still terrible. But no, I went into it with I've always had a very inquisitive mind. I love science. I love this field. And so I said, okay, like, what can we do? Like, how can we investigate this from a research, from a science perspective? So that's how I got in touch with you. Do you know it was 10 years ago this year? I've known you for 10 years now.
Well, you don't seem to have got any gray hair. I have in that 10 years.
No, I do.
You've just covered yours up.
So I knew that there was an importance here. I knew that this was a field that people are definitely very passionate about, but there was clearly a lack of science. And but having said that, this is a growing field of science in the last probably 20 years. There's been a lot more research attention, but having said that, there's still so much to be done. So yes, and you're exactly right. There is a massive, massive lack of funding because, you know, it's a pretty low priority. And with organizations that kind of fund animal welfare research, we're all fighting for kind of the same small pot of money.
The other thing is, which I think is inevitable, and it's, I'm not criticizing it, but when money is available, it's usually from particular shelters or organizations, and they have a particular agenda that they're interested in.
Exactly,
And I fully
exactly.
understand that's what they're going to focus on, but that's not necessarily what's so important. So I know it's very incredibly difficult to get funding to do work on aggression in dogs, because most organizations that want to promote dog welfare don't want to go into that issue because of they see it as potentially bad PR, and
Exactly.
it's not sexy. So what we need is more people like yourself willing to come forward and say, you know what, I think this is really important. And I've actually this year I've taken on two new PhD students who are going to be working on the issue of dog aggression
Nice.
directed to humans, and they're both self-funding. They're actually going to work as part of a team.
Nice.
And we're going to be looking at trying to develop a much more systematic way of really assessing the risk that is involved in this.
I
So
mean, no, and I think you're right. And I think there's such emotion, I think there's such human emotion attached to this. We don't want to see the negative outcomes. So because there's so much attached to it, then yeah, you're right. The money goes where do your homing. Like, I think a really good example of this is, there's this movement all over the US and in whole countries, like in Italy, for no kill, right? No kill cities, no kill counties, whatever. Which, great. I would love to see every dog that doesn't have a home go into a really good home. But for now, that's not the case. So my question is, and I haven't spent a lot of time looking into this, but my question is, hey, is this really the right, if we're considering the welfare and the quality of life of the dog, is this really the right choice?
And I think that's a it's a very bold statement for you to say that. I can get away with, I'm sat in academia, right? I'm all right. But yeah, a lot of people aren't saying that. And there is a difference between quantity of life and quality of life. And there are people
Exactly.
who say that, life is sacrosanct and whatever. And you can hold that belief, and I can respect that somebody holds that belief for whatever reason. But don't tell me that that mean equals good welfare.
Exactly.
That is your
Exactly.
ethical position, and that's fair enough. But that is not the same as, well, I'm interested in promoting animal welfare. And these are some of the ideas that people get confused about. When I was in general practice, I would often say, when somebody asked for their dog put to sleep, they're clearly upset. And I say, well, I honestly feel, this is an honor that we can do this to alleviate their suffering. We know what's going to happen, and we can alleviate it. I fully take the arguments in humans, and it is much more complicated in humans because dogs don't have big inheritances that they pass on, that people might be saying, oh, well, get rid of the dog and I can get his food bowl. And it is, an elderly person might think, oh, well, I'm a bit of a burden to my children, I should opt for euthanasia. So I don't think the two are, just because you respect one, that necessarily it applies to the other. But these are the difficult questions. And I think that, as I said, that has been one of the joys of working with you. You're self-funding, you're a free spirit. You can go where you want to within reason. I have to sometimes rate you back. But no, but you can address those sorts of topics in that. And this is my chance. And as I often say with, my little, this little podcast, thank you, because I know it's been a long journey. It's not been an easy journey always for you, and you've had a lot to cope with along the way, quite apart from the PhD, but you made it, and that is what makes a PhD, is that ability to stick with it when you want to give it up. Interestingly, Libby, who's one of the co-authors on the paper, she's the only person I have ever heard say she enjoyed every moment of her PhD, because I say the only thing that links a PhD, as far as I'm aware, is that it shows you're somebody who will stick with something even though you want to give it up. And she said she never felt like that. And I'm thinking, oh, well.
Oh no,
No.
it never occurred to me to give it up, but I did not enjoy every, trust me, I did not enjoy every
It is
minute of it.
a hard journey. But equally, and I don't think we should be, just to pick up, we should not be afraid of the truth. And that's what science gives us, is the best truth that we can get at the moment. It's not an absolute truth, but it says, on the basis of the evidence, this is what we think is going on. And if it comes up with something that is uncomfortable or politically uncomfortable, then let's manage it, but let's acknowledge it and not just sort of because so much suffering can come from well-meaning intention, and particularly with companion animals. And that's one of the things that has driven me in my career is, you know, good intention does not equate to good welfare. So
I totally agree. So yeah, we have to look at the things that people don't necessarily want to look at, because otherwise we're not going at the full picture. So
stick with it, keep in touch.
I will
keep doing the work. I know you will, and I know you'll keep chipping away at this, because yeah, as you say, this is something you're passionate about. And yeah, thanks a lot for everything. And
thank you.
And thank you to everybody for listening. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye now.